My name is Chris Capuccio. I've been using OpenBSD for a long time, using it in production, using it for routers, for servers, as my workstation. And in that use, I decided I wanted a couple tools. That's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Give you a little brief overview. This picture was provided for me by Burlington North Santa Fe. It's a wonderful train with the NSH logo on it. NSH is a program that provides a command line interface to routing on OpenBSD. And the goal of NSH originally for me was to have something that was a little simpler than a Unix system and something that was familiar enough for people who already had some experience with Cisco routers and switches, something that was similar enough that they could use it. NSH is basically a simple interpreter, and it's also a command line environment. It's got a configuration file, and it allows you to control lots of things. I'm going to go over that here. FlashRD is an installation script. It's not particularly all that complicated, except in how it layers things, and I'm going to go into that as well. FlashRD allows you to install OpenBSD on and create an image that you can move around, you can remotely upgrade rather easily. So I'm going to start with a little bit of history here. My production usage of this stuff started with a mid to late 90s ISP. I put on here just some of the things you had to deal with in an ISP, the point being that these are, the job of an ISP at this point in time was to connect the phone network and to provide internet functions over the phone network. So you had to have all these specialized protocols and functions in play, and the equipment that you used was almost always very specialized. And anyways, things are a little different now. A lot of companies use Ethernet over fiber or whatever, but because of this you had routers. Yeah, and Cisco was obviously one of the dominant companies. Cisco routers and switches everywhere. So if you were to telnet into a Cisco device, you would see something like this. You would see, it'd ask you for a password. You would have sort of a uniform interface. No matter what model of Cisco device you had, you could type interface something and get into that, number one, number two, number three. You could set your IP address. You could look at information about the interface, and it's the no matter what model you had, everything was fairly standard. Another nice thing about Cisco was that there was a unified configuration. Everything you did on the device was in one place. You set your host name, your password, your IP addresses, your routes, everything in one file. Of course, if you're routing on a Unix system, you have 10, 20 different files that you can edit. They all have different formats, they all have different commands, and this is sort of cumbersome, especially if you're trying to teach people who are just doing this as a job. They're not interested in the technology. They just want to come to work. They want to get stuff done, and they want to go home. Cisco is expensive. Every price is measured in multiples of 1,000. Predictable configuration, predictable performance, unpredictable bugs. Cisco is pretty legendary for that. Anybody who's had to use it for a long period of time can probably attest to that. And you can pay for a contract. It's always a nice feature. A lot of companies like to pay for contracts. If it worked before, this is an email from 1991, and this is some people describing using RS6000s, IBM RS6000 computers with custom interface cards for the original T3 backbone of the NSFnet. And they're saying it works extremely well. So that comes into PC-based routers. Maybe this slide's a little bit out of place, but I started using OpenBSD pretty seriously as a router with IPF, which was the integrated firewall from Darren Reed that eventually got removed. This is an example here of one command in OpenBSD and the Cisco equivalent to that command.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, this is... the Cisco equivalent, you know, you have this reverse net mask thing. I always thought that was great. You know, you have to define all these things. And in a real Cisco config, this is going to be in, you know, way, you know, this is going to be in 10 different places. You're going to have all this stuff in between. And for somebody just learning how to do it, this is kind of complicated. In OpenBSD, you could just put in one command and do the exact same thing. PC-based routers made possible by network cards. Essentially, you have a computer, you're plugged into a network, and you can, in software, manipulate the traffic. We have software implementations of VLAN trunking, 802.1Q, Ethernet link aggregation, 802.3AD, BGP, OSPF. PF is a great firewall. I don't know if anybody here uses it, but yeah. You guys use it. PF is really simple. It's kind of the opposite of IP tables. I don't know if anybody here uses IP tables, but it's
human readable.
It's tough. I have a hard time getting used to it, but I've just been spoiled with PF. This is the IBM RS6000 NSFNet node. So if you had an RS6000, you could put up to 5 T3 cards into it. There's a little DSU over here. That's plugged right into the telco circuit, and then this is the RS6000 unit. So, kind of, you know, if it worked, what's the problem? Why did Cisco get popular and make money? Well, aside from providing support contracts and all the other things they did, they provided reliable hardware. Hot closets, a story in hardware failure. Not all environments are as well controlled as government and university supercomputer labs. You didn't want that power supply anyways. You didn't want that CPU fan, that hard disk, or that customer. This was really a big problem for me. When I started using OpenBSD as a router, my first big use was in multi-tenant environments. So we'd go into a building, we'd bring in some kind of internet connection, and there would be 2, 5, 10 offices in there. This is before you had VLAN trunking. The best and simplest solution to give everybody separate networks and to provide some real security between them was to use multi-port Ethernet cards. But when you put these into a machine, invariably the machines are going to fail. And so, in 1999, Soren Christensen started Socrates Engineering. This is one of the cool little companies that I really like because he released embedded systems, maybe not in the traditional sense of the word, but they ran a regular PC operating system. You could run OpenBSD, Linux, NetBSD, whatever you want. The Socrates box would take a compact flash card. The newer ones, I think, take an SD card. And they were great. They had no moving parts. They were cheap, relatively cheap. Compact flash at the time wasn't too expensive. And this particular model, as I wrote here, would do 4,000 packets per second with OpenBSD 3.0. That was pretty good. About above 4,000, you'd live lock the box and you would be out of commission. But, in the early 2000s, 4,000 packets per second was pretty good. You know, if you had an ADSL connection, you had a T1, you were okay. And by this point, I had ported the FreeBSD VLAN trunking driver over to OpenBSD, and a lot of people improved it. And so you could plug one of these into an Ethernet switch, and there you go. So FlashRD is a program that's designed to install OpenBSD on Flash. One of the things that FlashRD does is it gives you a read-only environment by default instead of a read-write environment. It can be a read-write environment. It's easy to configure that way, but it doesn't. You know, it's not what I did first. There's a lot of contention as, oh, you don't even need to do this. It's a waste of time. Just set it up read-write. Well, in my experience, and I was putting lots of these in different places. A lot of these places didn't necessarily have reliable power, or had some other temperature, or who knows what, and I didn't. I didn't have really good luck even running things like pfSense on a compact flash. I would invariably have to replace some of them. Not a huge number, but I thought, how can I have these be more reliable? My goal was to use the cheapest flash that I could to buy, you know, spend 10, 20 bucks, plug in a new machine, and to get more reliability there, I had to go read-only. So with regard to flash reliability, there, at the last Usenix conference, there was a really interesting paper released where, I'm not going to pronounce this right, Mai Zhang did a presentation about the robustness of solid-state drives under power fault. And they built a little circuit where they could reliably and instantly cut power and restore power to flash drives that were plugged into SATA buses. When they did that, they found that 13 out of 15 drives would suffer significant and serious failures when you cut the power. And it's not because of flash wear. It's because of several other issues. I'm going to read a little quote here. 13 out of 15 of the tested SSD devices exhibit surprising failure behaviors under power fault, including bit corruption, shorn writes, unserializable writes, metadata corruption, and total device failure. And I've experienced enough total device failures with flash drives that I thought a read-only system was the way to go.
Is this during writes only, or just
this is mainly during writes? Yes. And so and they go into why power failure during a write causes problems with flash devices. There's a lot of technical reasons behind it, and if you look up the Mai Zhang Usenix paper, you'll be able to read it. So. So in 2000 and something, I don't know, I wrote a simple script called FlashDisk. And it accommodated small flash. It made it very easy to install OpenBSD onto one of these Socrates boxes. You just follow the directions. I posted some simple directions. You buy the right hardware, you plug in your flash drive, you run the script, and you can boot it on your Socrates box, and there you go. You can plug it in with a standard USB compact flash adapter. It was a Korn shell script, and it allowed you to take a 64 meg or 32 meg compact flash card, which at the time you could buy for around $10 or $20. All right, here in 2001, a 64 meg compact flash was expensive. Because if the Socrates box is $100, $150 bucks, and you have to spend $20 on the flash card, that's about the limit, especially if you're going to put out several of these. Popular, as it turns out, not for any good reason. FlashDisk was a really sloppy script. I wrote it basically to document the steps of how I installed it, sort of to myself. And then I realized that it worked, and I just started putting it out there for people to use. The reason it was popular was because the bootloader on OpenBSD did not use logical block addressing. It only supported cylinders, heads, and sector addressing. And with the CHS bootloader, if you didn't do things exactly right and have the exact right parameters, it wouldn't boot. And so if you plugged in a USB compact flash adapter into a PC, the device geometry, the cylinder head sector's geometry that your PC would get from the, would derive from the flash adapter would be different than what you would get when you plugged this into the Socrates box and booted it up. So part of the directions actually involved plug it into the Socrates box, make sure you update the BIOS to get the newest BIOS that'll show you the CHS readings, type in the CHS in the flash disk, and run it. You can't even, the way OpenBSD works, you can't even actually do that anymore. You can't use a disk label command and specify cylinders, head sectors that are different from what the kernel reads off the device. But that's okay because the bootloader now supports LBA. But flash disk ended up being popular, I think I realized later, because people were having a hard time getting a Socrates box to boot OpenBSD, period. And so this provided sort of a good way to do it. A lot of people wrote their own variations of it and then wrote guides on how to do this yourself by just looking at what the script did and just putting it as a how-to guide. And that was a smart thing to do. The knowledge about how to, you know, run these utilities, I mean, it's pretty simple, but people just don't do it because the installers and everything are automated. But, you know, when you first, I don't know, when I first started using Linux, 386 BSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, you had to sort of know how to do these things, and anyways. Flash just kind of gained attention every now and then, and I would get a bunch of emails about it, and there'd be some interest, and then it would go away. But it filled a need. But it had drawbacks. Like I said earlier, it was sloppy. It was hard to upgrade because it just installed it right under the Flash and just mounted it read-only. So you had this, all these files on your Flash mounted read-only. If you wanted to upgrade it remotely, you had to very carefully do it by hand. There was a fixed distribution list. You had to tell it exactly what library files, what binaries, exactly what you wanted to install onto the Flash. And so, as you can see with the Russian foreign minister here, he was very disgruntled. Superseded, in my opinion, by Daniel Miller's Flash Boot, which was a really cool script that used the OpenBSD build environment to create a RAM disk kernel that would have all whatever you wanted embedded into it, usually for networking, and it would be one file that you copy onto the Flash and boot, just like BSD.rd. I'm not sure what the equivalents are in NetBSD or any other system, but it was a build environment using all the default OpenBSD tools that would allow you to build a custom RAM disk kernel. Easy to remotely upgrade. It would give you something a lot like a Cisco router where you have one file that you copy onto the Flash, and now your system's upgraded once you reboot. Like I wrote here, not nearly as lame as Flash disk, but still a limited environment because you have to tell it, I want this component, this component, this component, this component, and now it's on your Flash. And that, here's a picture of George Bush preparing to launch Flash Boot. So, Flash RD. So, Flash Boot had an excellent idea. It used a RAM disk kernel. So, in 2009, you could get an 8-gig USB stick for around $20. Now I think they're like $10. In 2009, the internet did not run T3 circuits on IBM RS6000s for 14 years. But... But I thought, hey, maybe we can do better than flash disk. We could do multiple versions of the system on one flash by copying files, just like Flash Boot did. Easy upgrades, just like Flash Boot, because you can copy these single files over. And maybe we can do better than Flash Boot. How about having a full OpenBSD distribution inside those files? Maybe you could even install ports and packages just like a normal OpenBSD distribution. This is not a limited system. After all, if an 8-gig flash is $20, why would you want to put a 5-meg kernel on it and leave the rest of it free and not be able to use it? And, you know, go read, write, or read only as desired. So that's sort of the idea behind FlashRD, a unique layout to try and get the best of both worlds. So here I'm describing VND directories, tar directories, and the defaults of what is defined as what. VND directories are typically for read-only directories that are mounted right to the flash, but they come from this file that contains your virtual drive. It's just a VND, which is I'm sure there's equivalents in every other system.
Memory-backed.
It's not memory-backed, it's flash-backed. But it's a file, it's just like a virtual image that you mount as your device is like /dev/VND0, VND0 A, B, whatever. So with VND directories and Flash RD, those can be your read-only directories that have your system contents, or they can be read-write directories. And these are stored in the VND image, which I'll have a picture of here in a second. Then there's tar directories, and these are memory file systems that are mounted when you boot. And then the tar command is used to untar and populate the memory file system. It's very simple in that the default here is that /root/etc/bin/user/sbin/home are all VND directories. They're those read-only things out of this file that exists only on the flash. And then the var directory where you're writing logs and you have more activity, you have spool directories or whatever, would be a memory file system and gets populated when you boot up. Configurable in any direction. You could make everything a VND directory, you could make everything a tar directory. And these are just the kind of silly variable names I came up with, but I stuck with it. Here's the layout. So your flash file system, so right here, these are the three files you're going to see on the flash device. The BSD kernel with the RAM disk, the VND file, which is your virtual disk, and whatever tar directories you have. Very straightforward, except it's not. Inside the VSD kernel, there's the RAM disk, and the RAM disk contains the entire root file system. But all that really means is that it's got a bunch of empty directories. It's got slash dev that has all your real devices in it, but mostly empty. Then the VND file has the real contents for slash root in case you want to save your SSH host keys. It's got slash bin for your system binaries, etc configuration, sbin, more binaries, and slash usr, everything else. So in this scheme, Well, anyways, you might want to make slash home a VND directory too if you're going to have home directories. But if you're using this as a networking appliance, you might not care. That's mostly what I do, so I left the default configuration like this. Basically, these partitions in the bootstrap get mounted over the RAM disk. So when you do anything in these directories, it comes out of the VND file, and if you can also go into read-write mode and save stuff into that VND file. And as soon as you reboot, let's say you were to move openbsd.vnd and rename it, copy in a different VND file, you could reboot into a whole different system pretty easily. Because at that point, you're just moving these files on the flash. The flashrd RAM disk, it contains only slash dev and only enough binaries to bootstrap the VND image. The RAM disk has no way of knowing which disk you booted from. So, in the OpenBSD kernel, if you're net booting or if you're booting from some mysterious way, typically the kernel can tell the startup scripts and pass a variable on saying the boot disk was WD0, WD1, SD0, whatever. When you're booting from a RAM disk, that variable says you're booting from RD0A. The problem is, you're always booting from RD0A. I have no idea what the physical device is called. So to fix that, I wrote a simple stupid shell routine that goes through and tries to figure out where FlashRD is really stored. And it goes through the first three SCSI disks and the first three IDE disks, first four, I should say. And then it tries to mount them, and if it can successfully mount them by testing the return value from the mount command, then it tests to see if the openbsd.vnd file is there. If openbsd.vnd is there, then it assumes that that's the FlashRD distribution. If you have multiple disks with FlashRD plugged into the same machine, then the order here is important, because the one that has SD3A will get chosen over SD2A, and so on. But that's not a typical scenario, but I guess it'll be important to understand if you can actually use it. So what this does is it tries to find your root. When FlashRD boots, tries to find your root disk manually, then it mounts it. And then it goes through and, why go through all the trouble? The RAM disk has to stay really small. When you create a RAM disk in OpenBSD, that memory gets lost permanently. So if you have a 5 meg RAM disk, you lose 5 megs of memory. And on a small system, that could be a problem. Even on a big system, that could be a problem, because the low memory in the system is used for different things. And the more of it you steal, the more problems you might end up having. So FlashRD does a couple things to try and make the RAM disk as small as possible. It uses CrunchGen to take the mount, LS, and any utilities you want. It uses CrunchGen to make them all one binary with one set of library routines that are all linked into the slash sbin slash mount, and all the actual commands are point to one binary.
A bit like BusyBox.
Yeah. And so because the RAM disk has to stay small, and because we're doing this weird thing where we take this VND file and mount it over the RAM disk, we have to populate slash etc slash sbin. We have to populate all these things before etc rc even runs, because we have to mount etc before we can find etc rc, for instance. So, and this just is sort of a simple idea of how it works on the screen. Um, So Flash RD is a read-only environment, typically, with slash var on MFS, slash temp on MFS, and you can type in the RW command to switch to read-write. So let's say you want to install a package, or you want to do whatever you want to do, you can just type RW. You can edit etc, you can add users, do whatever you want. But if you want to keep the machine in read-only mode, you can type RO to go back. If you want to always run the machine as read-write, you could simply build everything as a VND directory when you first run the FlashRD script to build your image, and then remove the RO call from rc.flashrd.local. To upgrade it, you would run FlashRD itself. You're going to get a new VND image file. You're going to get the RAM disk kernel, and you would take those files and copy them onto your existing system. That's going to upgrade your system and completely wipe everything out. So if you're running special packages, you need to make sure that you copy those in. And when you run FlashRD, you run it against a directory hierarchy. So if you already have a system that already does what you want, you can run FlashRD against that mounted hierarchy, and it'll turn that directly into an image. It doesn't try and build the system from scratch. It doesn't do anything complicated. It's really simple. The way I typically use it is I'm using FlashRD to run maybe a couple packages, but mostly base OpenBSD utilities. And those base OpenBSD utilities are all configured in etc. The configuration files don't really change. So I can keep those configuration files in a one-time compressed little archive that then gets extracted once. When I copy a new VND image, I want to upgrade. I want to go from OpenBSD 4.7 to 5.0. So I copy the 5.0 VND image over. I copy over the new kernel. And whatever configuration files I want to keep go into the one-time.tgz archive that also goes on the flash. And the next time you reboot, FlashRD will see that, oh, there's these certain configuration files in there. It'll unpack them over your base system, and you'll have a system that's customized with those particular files in it. The advantage is it's simple. You copy, you reboot, and you're done, as long as your archive, as long as your one-time.tgz has everything in it that you want. The drawback is it can be too much work in some cases. If you have lots of packages installed, or if you're only running one system on FlashRD and you're not running 20 or 40, then the time you spend figuring out how to do that might not be worth the effort. FlashRD needs to learn about sysmerge. I do too. One of these days I want to figure out how to use that thing. I still do it by hand. FlashRD environment. So my primary environment is up on hilltops and up on different places where, you know, office closets and wherever, you know, you have kind of a nasty environment, probably not going to have reliable power all the time. But I couldn't go and take pictures in any of those places. Didn't feel like driving up any hilltops. Here's a picture of our colo facility that we're building right now. Got a bunch of racks and 10 gig switches and stuff. But I've also got several boxes here running. I've got DNS servers, NAT, firewall, layer 3 traffic boxes, and it's really simple. It's just a flash plugged into the back of the machine, as you can see. But, you know, it's got, the main use is for where you have no moving parts, and so, insert pictures here. So, some people aren't looking forward to the Unix command line. I'm going on to NSH now. This is, FlashRD is sort of the build your images and do that kind of stuff. NSH is the command line interface. And so, why would you use NSH? Well, if you're training people on Cisco switches, and you then want those people to run your OpenBSD firewall, you want them to do stuff with PF, NSH might be useful because they don't have to sit down and learn how to do you know, learn where all the configuration files are and get used to a system that works very differently than the Cisco switch or the Cisco router. How many people here run routers on a Linux box or a BSD box or... Okay, so you guys are sort of candidates for maybe bringing this to work, maybe doing this kind of thing in an environment where you have to interact with more than just you. It has to be, you know, you're responsible for it, but there's going to be more people that have to change settings or that have to look at it. And so that's the goal of NSH, was to make it a little easier to train people. I wrote here, in the end, you have to train them on what they need to use every day. People that maybe are not comfortable with the command line interface, that are not comfortable with Unix, you may not even have the luxury of people who are comfortable typing at all. And, you know, the average Linux BSD distribution has discrepancies. You have files all over the place, you have all these different formats. So with NSH, there are several goals. It's a shell and an interpreter. Basic idea here is to bridge the gap in the implementation. We're trying to keep it simple, but I don't want to dilute OpenBSD too much. I'll give a little example of this. In NSH, I had it sort of working and looking a little bit Cisco style, where you could go into, you know, type interface this, IP that. And then I thought, okay, well, how about PF firewall? How are we going to integrate that? Well, at first I thought maybe I should take PFCTL, the command that you use, kind of like with IP tables or whatever the other equivalent is. It's a command that configures the kernel with your firewall rules. So I thought, well, maybe PFCTL should be turned into a library, and I could write these special PF commands, and I had all these crazy ideas. And then I realized that PF is a moving target. Every 6 months, it would change pretty significantly, and to do what I was suggesting without everybody who's writing PF thinking it was a good idea, or even if they did, didn't really make sense. So to not dilute OpenBSD too much, the way I ended up incorporating PF and turned out several other utilities was by calling PFCTL directly and just taking the PF configuration file and incorporating it into NSH. So you don't have to learn two syntaxes. You just take the PF syntax and it goes right into NSH. PF was user-friendly enough and good enough that there was no reason to try and, you know, possibly reinvent it. That's kind of a conflicting goal with, you know, having a really simple shell and interpreter, but the PF syntax was really very nice, and like I showed earlier, the Cisco equivalent sucks. Another goal of NSH is to don't bore you with too much configuration. If there's a system setting that's default, don't save it in the configuration. It's default, it's already that way. The configuration really only has what changes. Cisco does the same thing. If you go into a Cisco router, you type in a command that sets something to its default, and you type in show run, you will not see that command in the config. I like that. Another idea with NSH is to have one place to do everything, all your configuration, your troubleshooting, except advanced troubleshooting. Building too much stuff into NSH is not worth it. You can just simply shell out and do this. If you already know how to do advanced troubleshooting, you probably would need to shell out anyways. One of the goals here is unified configuration. Just like a Cisco, we want to have one configuration file that'll take the box and take it from start to finish. Vaguely Cisco-like, and like I said, these are sometimes conflicting goals. I developed NSH part-time for 11 years. Slow movement was frustrating to potential users. I just got certain things done in it. I kind of developed it to do what I needed to do in different areas, and I was kind of hoping that people would contribute changes, and I just didn't have it far enough for it to really be interesting enough to people, I think. It was also a learning process for me. It touches several areas of the system. It now supports virtually every networking service in OpenBSD. It supports IPv6. It supports routing tables, multiple routing tables. But like I said, here all combinations of commands are not fully tested. If you go to GitHub, for instance, there's issues listed right now that show things that need work. I did just recently create a mailing list for NSH, and I did this because there was lots of potential interest in the past. I never bothered to have a mailing list before, but maybe putting it, maybe that'll help if people do want to develop and work on it more. This is just a sample of, if you were to take a box already running OpenBSD, maybe as a router with PF, and you wanted to use it to, you wanted to use NSH to manage it, this is what you would do. You would copy your configuration files to certain certain places where NSH writes its temporary configuration files. Then you would run NSH, and you would basically tell it to write that config back in its own format to disk. This will talk to the kernel. It'll save all your IP addresses. It'll save your host name. It'll save most everything. There's a couple actions you take in NSH that are mediated through a database. For instance, when you tell NSH that you want to enable PF, NSH doesn't go to the kernel and say, is PF enabled? NSH goes to the database and says, is PF enabled? And so it has to create that database, and so you have to type in certain commands by hand to make the NSH config work right when you write it to disk and save it. This is sort of a sample config with routing tables. So it's a very minimal, simple config. It was actually just one I used for testing. And the example here has three Ethernet interfaces, VR 0, 1, and 2. These are Ethernet interfaces off of a Socris or PC Engine's box. They have R-Domain 1, R-Domain 2 on the VR 1 and VR 2 interfaces. That puts those interfaces into totally separate routing domains with their own routing table, their own default route. They're completely separate from everything else. And that's a really nice feature in OpenBSD. I think everybody has that feature by now, maybe not. But it's the way it's implemented in OpenBSD is still sort of maturing. You can use it with MPLS. You can do BGP IP VPNs with it already. OpenBSD already has a label distribution protocol daemon. And so this doesn't have that in the config, but and because I haven't personally used an OpenBSD yet, I'm about to interface it with some Juniper routers. This is a simple config that shows you, okay, here's how you set rdomain1 and rdomain2. Just like you would type in ifconfig vr1 rdomain1. Here's the rest of the config. So this is where NSH becomes kind of cool. This is your normal default route, and this is in rtable 0, and so there's no special prefix. This is rtable 1. This is your whole separate routing table, and so you can actually tell NSH rtable 1 management rtable, give it a label. So then you can add a route that only exists in that routing table. So if you have an interface bound to this routing table, or if you have a daemon running in this routing table, and you execute a command, it can only talk to stuff in this routing table. This is, Cisco and Juniper call this VRF, or virtual routing and forwarding. And one of the cool things with NSH is that you can put not only routes in separate routing tables, you can run daemons in separate routing tables. You can have a routing table for management of your network, and you can only run SSH in that routing table. So the SSH config would appear under this R table statement and not in the general system R table. So I guess this example really isn't that exciting, but the flexibility of being able to do it this way is. And OpenBSD doesn't really, like I said, this is still being sort of fleshed out in OpenBSD, but I think this is kind of a neat implementation of it, and it's a little more sensical than using the route-t exec and doing it the normal way from the command line. It sort of fits in with the goal, I think, of making NSH make things a little easier, a little simpler for people. So then if you're on the command line of NSH and you type in rtable 1, now everything you do in NSH is done in rtable 1. So you type rtable 1, okay, it tells you, okay, you're doing stuff in rtable 1. But now I do a trace route in R table one, and that trace route goes through the default route in R table one and not anywhere else. The command line equivalent would be route dash t exact one, or trace route, whatever. I've never actually used the command line equivalent. I've only used it in SH. And then when you're in the command line, if you wanted to type no R table, you're back into the main system routing table. And so you can not only can you do diagnostics and commands through NSH this way, but you can configure NSH to start your daemons, your whatever, in those routing tables and then save it in the NSH config the same way. Then here's a simple configuration for those of you that would use NSH or use OpenBSD or have a router at home running on a system like this. This is probably what your configuration would look like. You'd have your name servers, your LO, your local host interface. You don't even need it, but you could have it. Your VR0 interface probably plugs into your cable modem or your DSL, and you're going to get DHCP, and or maybe you're going to do PPPoE, which is being implemented in NSH right now. Not there yet. Then you're going to have maybe an internal interface, which is, in this case, VR2. ENC0 is the default interface that comes with OpenBSD. You're only going to use that if you're running VPNs. PFLog is another default interface that comes with OpenBSD. And that interface would be used if you're trying to capture, if you're running the log statement in a PF config and you want to watch to see what is generated from that, you would run TCP dump against that interface. It's a virtual interface. It's kind of weird. You're going to turn on IP forwarding. This is the same as running a sysctl command and storing an etc sysctl.cfg. If you have a router that's busy, you need to make the queue larger. And then here's how we integrate PF rules. So like I was saying earlier, instead of taking PF and re-implementing the PFCTL, which would have been a huge amount of work and a moving target, I just take the PF config and copy it right into here. So that actually works out pretty well. The PF rules are nice, simple, logical, and we just copy them in here. When you take this config and you first boot your system, this part of the config gets written to a text file in PFCTL, then gets told to enable PF and load that config into the kernel. That's the interpreter part here. So then, let's say you want to have a DHCP server. Well, we do the same thing. We just take the whole DHCP config and embed it right into NSH config. So you have one place, one file to copy. If you have somebody who doesn't really know OpenBSD and is working on your router, they're probably not going to touch these areas that they don't know. But they do know about the thing they're supposed to do, and that's really all that matters. Enable the DHCP server. Do the same thing for NTP. Enable the NTP server. Same thing again for SSH. So this is a part of NSH where you're using it to control external commands and aggregate their config files into one. That's really all it does in this level here, but it's a very nice feature. And if you wanted to run SSH only in a certain routing table, then this whole config would be indented underneath R table 1 or R table 4. So if your network policy dictated that maybe you're at some point you start running a VRF for all your management. Let's say you run an ISP, and you don't want your customers to ever log into your switches or your routers or your radios or whatever. Your customers will be on their own VRF. Your management interface will be on a different VRF, and you set your policy rules to only allow your work network or your VPNs or whatever the case is. You only allow those guys to talk to the management network. That's kind of what you want, right? I mean, if you don't want people hacking in, or trying to hack in, or you don't want to expose potentially vulnerable services. And so NSH makes that possible to do with OpenBSD in one config file in an easy-to-read format. I know that, the concept of a BGP MPLS setup is pretty foreign to most people, even who do networking every day, unless they get into that side of it. But OpenBSD makes it really accessible. And I'm going to be putting up configs on the NSH website that make it really easy to do, and maybe more people will start doing it. MPLS is really cool. So then I was kind of rambling on about how NSH can control all these external commands. This is just a list of the external commands that NSH knows how to control today. It's not super sophisticated. Basically, you're just telling it to load the config file, reload, enable the command. But in some cases, you're telling it to show BGP neighbors. Well, in Cisco, you do show BGP neighbors. Well, in NSH, show BGP neighbors does the same thing.
What about CARP?
CARP is all done through the kernel, and it is supported in the interface config.
RelayD?
RelayD is on here.
Sorry.
And then I got a whole other page here. I got two pages. So we got both OSPF and OSPF version 3 for IP6, BGP, RIP, LDP for MPLS, RelayD for your layer 3... Any of your, RelayD is awesome, and I'm just learning actually how to use it. IPsec CTL is managed through NSH, so NSH will allow you to configure a VPN to start it, and it'll control ISA, KMP, and IPsec CTL, and store the config in one place for you. It'll do the same thing with IkeD, which is the newer version, which is the IPsec version 2 service. It'll do the same thing with a bunch of other commands. And so DHCP server, SNMP server, control them all through here. SSH, MTP, ifstateD. You can control the proxies through NSH. You can control NPPPD, which is a brand new thing that just added to 5.3 for doing L2TP. I'm not sure if I listed. Oh, yeah. You can even control SMTP and LDAPD, which are pretty mature now. When you're running NSH, it's got a verbose mode. So if you're doing things where NSH does all the interface configuration, and a lot of what it does, it talks directly to the kernel when it doesn't involve those utilities in the last two pages of lists. And when it talks directly to the kernel, there's a bunch of potential information that it hides unless you tell it to go into verbose mode, and then it'll add some, it'll spice things up a little bit. It's also got a monitor command, which is just like running route monitor from the command line. It's actually just copy of the code. And NSH, I take code from telnet, FTP, ifconfig, route, ARP, a bunch of different commands. And I wrote a bunch of stuff as I was kind of playing with it and learning how to do some of this. And so where I copied code, I took the original copyright. Where I wrote new stuff, I just created a new file with my own copyright. So in-depth configuration, in-depth debugging is outside of the current scope of NSH. And if you're really having weird problems, you already have to know how to use the commands anyways, and you're going to be doing it from the OpenBSD command line, not the NSH command line.
I've got gaming trace route then.
90%
of the way there.
Yeah, that's exactly. The future for NSH is we need a web interface. A simple web UI that would allow you to change all the simple stuff without even using the command line, but still use... What I was thinking was maybe have some simple web code that would create an NSH config that could then get run by the interpreter. Easy adjustments for less technical folks. So the tool of FlashRD and NSH, in my mind, are kind of for people who are consultants, people who are IT, or maybe people who are looking to OEM. I know several companies have used NSH in the past as part of their products. I don't know much about it, where things ended up, but that's it. So I don't know if anybody has any questions, any ideas, to spark any thoughts.
So the most important command in the Cisco world is the question mark.
If you type a question mark in NSH, it'll give you a list of commands. If you type in that command and then a question mark, it'll give you syntax.
Ooh. Right on.
But if you want to know how to configure PF, you have to read the man page.
But it's a good man page.
That's a good man page.
And there's a book of PF, and there's a chapter in Lucas's book.
Can you interface with man pages directly through NSH?
You could, well,
or display them, I suppose.
You could do bang man, and then the it'll run a regular external command if you do bang. So.
Any thoughts on the web interface? What might it be based on? Or Nginx will be in based in past Apache. You know?
I'm already using Nginx on a lot of machines. I don't know yet. I don't know.
Web. I don't know.
It's going to be something really. It's going to be really minimal and simple as far as the infrastructure behind it. That's all I really know. I haven't figured out how to do it yet. Or what I really want to use or what I like. I'm kind of talking to people and asking people, hey, if I want to do this, how would I do it? I'm bugging people, emailing them, and maybe I'll get some kind of replies.
You looked at Hasserl with, like, Lighty or something like that?
It's Hasserl?
Hasserl, yeah.
I don't know anything about Hasserl.
Hasserl is basically just a really dumb CGI that interfaces with the shell, Bash, or whatever you've got. And it basically allows you to embed syntax in HTML that will basically be handed out to the shell to interpret. It's really dangerous.
Yes. Yeah.
But if you wrap it correctly, and you limit what you take
yeah.
input, then it might be useful. But the reason I bring it up is it's incredibly lightweight.
That might be a little too lightweight. I kind of wanted to have something where there was some like a kind of a nice looking interface with some kind of firewall in between where everything you do gets sort of filtered properly. So I just don't know yet how it would work.
I've been down this road before with a couple of other projects that were all CLI based, trying to then put a web interface on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's way harder than you would think.
That's
way harder.
But what's nice here is that it's just really writing the config file.
That could be
really
choose menus and generate a file.
So, as you're talking, I'm translating all this into OpenWRT, which is where I
so
am. My so, they have a thing called UCI, a way of harmonizing the crazy configuration files. And then they've got a bunch of script infrastructure that takes those configurations and writes the configuration that the program actually needs, so that's how that works. And then they have this thing called Lucy,
mm-hmm.
which is a Lua-based webby interface thing that basically wraps all that UCI interface in a nice graphic web interface.
Yeah.
How that all works, I've never looked at.
Really around. Well done. The end result is you have an Etsy config directory that has everything laid out in a file structure.
Right.
And then you've got this daemon that gets called, and it basically reads all that. And in the OpenWRT world, it gets rid of the NVRAM, right? So it'd be a little bit different.
Well, there's no NVRAM anymore.
Okay.
I mean, that's a few generations. So
Lucy can also be themed.
Right.
Themed, yeah. Lucy can be themed, yeah.
Is Lucy the Lua config interface?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of thought I saw a really nice demo of somebody's, I believe, OpenBSD-based firewall product where they put up a web interface. They used some nice AJAX controls that made it really, slick and smooth. But what they did that I thought was great was they even had a tab where you could click on and get the command line interface from the web browser, which was great. But I guess that's not really.
FreeNAS does that, but the developer said that's the hardest part of the whole project. It's that damn JavaScript shell.
Which I use regularly.
Yep, amen.
Yeah, it looked like it might be tricky to do, but the web interface by far is way more tricky than figuring out how to, tell the kernel to route something or any of that. Just because it's nowhere near anything I normally do. So
2 cents here for, I've worked with a menu-based system, which I would rely on when I was trying to do something that I didn't know how to do through the command line, particularly I need to do it in a hurry and client's worth tapping the watch, you know. One of the features that it had that you just might consider is, you know, fill in the parameters for whatever it was I wanted on the pretty menu page, you know, that I want to do this or I want to do that kind of thing. But it had an option where you could say, and then show me what command you're generating out of this. So that now I know how it does that. So if I want to do a command line, if I want to, you know, do something else with it, I can. So
that wouldn't be hard to add to NSH for the, that would be easy to add. I could simply add an option where if you go to verbose mode, it would, when it runs a command, it would just spit that out as it runs it. Mm-hmm. NSH has an interpreter function where when you boot up an NSH-based system, and I run NSH on lots of systems, and it runs start to finish. It runs every command, does everything for me. I don't have rc.local or rc script running separate stuff. When it boots up, it runs an interpreter function that reads the config file and then runs all the commands as if you were typing them in. And so the order that they're listed in the config file becomes critically important, because if you do one thing before another, it's not going to work right, mm-hmm. as far as the kernel is concerned or whatever. But in that interpreter function, there's also a verbose mode where when you boot the system up with nsh-i in the config file name, it interprets it. nsh-vi interprets it with verbosity, which shows you exactly what command it's interpreting before you see whatever output you're going to see. Mm-hmm. And so in that verbosity, it could also show you what command it's executing. A lot of what NSH does, aside from running those two-page list of utilities, are all handled in a very similar way. There's one set of routines that handles all of them in NSH. But everything else NSH does, configuring interfaces, adding routes, handling a database, routing tables, all this stuff, is a lot of it's done directly with the kernel. And because it's done directly with the kernel, those type of things, the equivalent command, like the equivalent ifconfig command or something, would actually be a lot of work to make NSH displayed.
No, I was actually thinking more from the web interface, because that's where you're taking somebody who doesn't know how to do it, perhaps through the command line. Maybe they prefer the web interface, but maybe they're doing it that way because they don't know how to do it through the command line, and they'd like to know how to do it through the command
line. That's pretty much how I envision the web interface working. Was creating, it would generate the command line or the config file for you, and then you could just look at what you did.
Yeah, you got a little checkbox or a tab or something. So show me, and there would be cases I remember where I would use it where I wouldn't ever have the menu system do it. I would just set it up and then say, "What's the command for?" Because that's really not quite what I want to do, but that's 80% of what I want to do, mm-hmm. and then I need to tweak it with some option that isn't in the menu system or something, you know?
Yeah. That's
food for thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking as far as...
A similar example with Hurricane Electric's tunnel broker for their IPv6 configuration. There's this nice thing, you know, you've just clicked on everything written that you've given you, the IP addresses for the tunnel endpoints. And then there's this page that says, well, how do I configure that on my client device? And what system do you have? And here's a drop down. You say, oh, I'm using Linux with, you know, IP route 2 utilities. And you go click, and then boom, there's the configuration right there. And you just cut and paste out of that in here. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Previously, I've worked at a small ISP in Arizona, and moving here, some other people are going to have to do some more support for it. So, and one guy who's probably going to do most of it is the Cisco guy. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, having like one guy that can do all this stuff never scales well, especially if you're the guy.
And you want to go on vacation.
Yeah.
Power cycle.
When you can simplify the config, it becomes way easier.
Yeah.
The answer of take 2 bits and call me in the morning only works once.
So,
fortunately, 90% of the solution is replacing the power supply and so forth.
How small with the flash RD thing?
So the minimal flash, well, okay. So flash RD was typically you'd encapsulate the whole OpenBSD system. The minimal flash you'd really want for that is maybe 1 gig. You could tell it to encapsulate just a very small number of commands, and then you can make it as small as you want. But it's not. If you want a system for setting up a router with a 32 meg flash or something, then flash boot is really what you'd use, not flash RD. Flash boot would allow you to make the absolute smallest kernel, smallest everything, and that's what we need on those environments.
Did that work with floppies back in the day?
Flash boot? I guess you could. I think it would create something too big for most floppies. Because it's a whole kernel. And the RAM disk is one file.
You're planning on building your system based on the sale they're having for you.
Exactly. It's coming up.
Yep, big announcement. April 6th, 12 to 4 will be their antique sale. Check it out.
How do they define antiques?
I was just going to ask the same thing. Are you going Commodore 64s or Pentium 3s?
Exactly. More like the Commodore.
Any floppy that's got a mag or more on it is